Chat. Malcolm Turnbull announced the laws of math do not apply here.
One of my favourite brands of comedy, Ariel, is brown people and black people making fun of white people.
Senators have been dropping like flies recently.
Shouting out the fact that in the Knowles-Carter family, women just have one name.
Back Chat on FBI Radio.
Sydney, what's up? You're listening to Backchat, the freshest wrap of news and current affairs on the radio. It's me, Osman Faruqi.
And I'm Sam Johncher.
Thanks for tuning in this morning. And I every week for like the last 6 months, I've been like, what a week in Canberra. It's all been happening. Citizenship drama. And then, Sam, you tend to chime in with something like, we'll probably be talking about it next week as well.
Probably be talking about it next week. And here we are.
The prophecy has been fulfilled. Somehow, even if we didn't think it was possible, the drama has spiraled even further out of control. And it was kind of like a mixed week for our federal politicians. In some regards, there were some loose ends tied up. We had the Australian Electoral Commission. They conducted recounts and confirmed who some of the new politicians would be entering the Senate. So replacing Scott Ludlam and Larissa Waters, who, if you remember, were the first two senators to kick off the whole citizenship fiasco.
The first two of the citizenship seven.
Well, now we're up to like the citizenship 19 or something absurd. We found out that they would be replaced by Jordan Steele John in WA, replacing Scott Ludlam. He's the youngest ever federal politician. He's only 23.
And he's a strong disability advocate.
He is. And he's already made a couple of quips about the fact that because he's in a wheelchair, Parliament will have to upgrade their facilities to be able to be more accessible. So it's kind of weird it's taken this long for Parliament to get its shit sorted in that regard, but, you know, now they'll have to. And Andrew Bartlett, the former leader of the Australian Democrats, will be replacing Larissa Waters. But it's not all as clear as those situations. So another senator who was caught up in the citizenship scandal was Fiona Nash. She's the former deputy leader of the National Party. She was booted out of Parliament by the High Court, and her replacement is a Liberal Party candidate called Holly Hughes. The problem for Holly Hughes is that even though she's technically the next in line to replace Nash, she hasn't been confirmed. And in fact, the High Court has said that it'll have to be, I guess, assessing whether she's actually eligible to enter the Senate for an entirely different set of reasons, according to the Constitution.
Still Section 44, though.
Still Section 44.
Just a different part of it.
A different subsection.
So, subsection... This subsection of Section 44 that Holly Hughes is caught up in says that anyone running for Parliament cannot hold an office of profit under the Crown. So that excludes pretty much like all public servants, you know, teachers, government workers, ABC journos, and possibly Holly Hughes, because when she didn't get that, seat, she was appointed to the Administrative Appeals Tribunal, which is definitely an office of profit under the Crown.
It's a pretty cushy office of profit under the Crown as well.
Brandis was kind to her.
Yeah, I think there's been some reporting. Actually, BuzzFeed did some fantastic stories earlier this year looking at the huge number of appointments to that particular body made by George Brandis. And a lot of those people were Liberal Party donors, Liberal Party luminaries, and ex-candidates. And I guess Holly Hughes was kind of in a position where she was given that role. No one really thought it was a big deal. And now it could be stopping her from getting elected to the Senate. But that's just like, I guess that's a rippling effect of this situation and how it just doesn't seem to end. But in addition to that particular hurdle for the Liberal Party, we've also got John Alexander, who's a Liberal MP for Bennelong, which used to be John Howard's old seat in Northwest Sydney. He, it turns out, is probably also a British citizen.
And knew this and decided not to come forward with it.
All these people that apparently, like, what were they doing for the last 6 months? This was all playing out. They thought that they could get away with it, but it's not going to work.
It's not going to work. But this is a particularly spicy one because Bennelong was held by John Howard until 2007, when he also no longer was Prime Minister. But Labour took over that seat in 2007.
They did. Maxine McHugh, yeah, the former Late Line host.
Mm. And if things went to a by-election, who knows what could happen?
Yeah, the interesting thing about Alexander is that while most of the politicians we've been talking about are in the Senate, and so far there's only been one in the lower house, Barnaby Joyce, who's run afoul, he's now been forced to quit, and there'll be a by-election on December the 2nd. John Alexander is the second person in the lower house. There's the story out in the Sydney Morning Herald this morning which suggests that he probably will quit and trigger another by-election, but that will be December 16th because he waited so long. So the government is going to have one by-election December 2nd in New England, another by-election December 16th, all while technically not commanding a clear majority on the House of Representatives. So that's leading everyone to like, well, is this a constitutional crisis? Does the government not have the numbers? Are they deliberately going to withhold Parliament from sitting in the House to stop this being tested? What's going on? The Greens leader, Richard Di Natale, is particularly irate by this whole thing. He's called it a constitutional crisis. He said that Malcolm Turnbull is losing the plot. And he even made a comment yesterday that some people thought went too far. He said that the Governor General should intervene and sort this mess out. And it's not quite, he wasn't quite explicit in saying that the Governor General should take a certain course of action. But given the powers available to the Governor General and the very high profile history of the Governor General intervening in Australian politics, namely 1975 and the dismissal of the Whitlam government, people have interpreted that statement by Richard Di Natale to mean he basically wants the Governor General to come in, sack the government and call an election. And while like there might be some temptation in that because, you know, a lot of people don't necessarily like this government, including Richard Di Natale himself. Anthony Albanese, the Labor former Deputy Prime Minister and current member for Grainler, he's gotten very upset about it and said that, look, even if you don't like this government, even if you don't like this constitutional crisis that's rolling out, getting the Governor General to intervene and sack the government using their reserve powers is not the way to go. What do you reckon, Sam? Is it a good fix or is it overstepping the mark?
Well, I mean, Labor's smarting for obvious reasons, you know. They lost out last time. I mean, you know, I'm sure they'd like to be vindicated, but no one, you know, Whitlam still was taken away from them. You know, I think they're never going to forgive
that. It's a sore spot.
Yeah, it does seem a bit too far. You know, I mean, I feel like the government is heading towards ahead. I don't think we need the Governor General to intervene.
I think there's a couple of things about this that kind of stand out for me. Like, one is that there is this very real constitutional question, and it just seems like so many people are getting swept up in it, and that in and of itself is a distinct issue. Like, is it feasible, sustainable to keep this clause in the constitution? How do we work that out? But then the flow-on impacts it's having on the rest of our politics also seem quite significant, because the government has a lot of challenges it should be dealing with. It's not as though everything is peachy in Australia right now.
Yeah, and next week we have the same-sex marriage survey results coming out, and if the government decides that it doesn't want to vote on anything, that could really, really stall any movement on this issue that we've been dealing with now also for months.
Absolutely. The Australian Council of Trade Unions also issued a statement this week that said that all controversial legislation should be suspended until the High Court clears up the citizenship issue for everyone. So that's obviously in their interests to make that point, because there's, I think, four or five significant pieces of legislation around industrial relations reform that the ACTU sees being anti-union that they want to see knocked off. So it is starting to spill out into the rest of our politics as well. And it doesn't seem like there's an end date to this. You would have thought, well, okay, the High Court's decided which of the Citizenship 7 should be kicked out. Now the AEC has announced their replacement. It's time to draw a line under this. But now we've got more politicians than ever facing this kind of spotlight and scrutiny. And it, like, again, I'm not saying that let's get the Governor General involved, but there needs to be some sort of circuit breaker.
Yeah,
and
some sort of line in the sand.
Yeah.
This could go on forever. Turns out this has been going on for a long time.
Yeah, yeah.
The ABC put out this pretty fun article this week. Apparently, 11 PMs out of just 29 from Australia's history possibly were ineligible.
Really?
Under Section 44. Four of them were, you know, granted, they were PM before we had citizenship here.
Right,
so
right.
Can't blame them. But seven after that, including Joseph Lyons, John Curtin, and Alfred Deakin, names you're all probably familiar with from our past.
Yeah.
All of them had parents born overseas.
And there's something.
Maybe didn't look into that.
There's something that all of these MPs, the ones you've mentioned, Sam, and the ones that are being swept up, caught up in this at the moment, something they have in common.
Yeah, that they're all white people.
Yeah, yeah. What do you reckon about that?
So, I mean, I reckon this is pretty. I mean, you know, so a number of people, including the politicians caught up in this, had said, you know, well, we're a multicultural country, maybe we should amend the Constitution to reflect the fact that we're multicultural and then get rid of this Section 44 clause. But it's worth noting that, like, all of these people are, they're white people with families from the UK and Ireland. And what's more likely is that it's never occurred to these white people in Australia that maybe they don't have an automatic right to be politicians here. It's like they've never been reminded of the fact that maybe they aren't 100% Australian because they supposedly look Australian.
Totally. Yeah, it's very noticeable, I think, that the few politicians we have from non-English-speaking backgrounds, people like Penny Wong and Sam Dasjari, they tick the boxes, they crossed the T's and dotted the I's. They obviously are very visibly migrants in the context of Australia, and they wanted to make sure that there was no risk of them being fallen afoul of these laws. But as you point out, like, these politicians that have very, very recent English or New Zealand ancestry just assumed, well, yeah, I mean, the English conquered Australia and, you know, they set up the the regime here. Of course I'm an Australian. There's not a big deal about it.
Seems fine.
Totally, yeah.
And it's never occurred to them.
Yeah, I think there's a lot to be said about that. It's also nice to have someone else on the show have a go at white people for spreading love.
Well, I don't know. I mean, I've got an American accent. People constantly remind me of the fact that I'm not from here.
Oh, well, we were both saying earlier that we are, in fact, both dual citizens.
Yeah.
I think Ariel, the regular co-host, is also a dual citizen. And it's not unusual in Australia for this to be the case, right? I think it's nearly 50% of people in New South Wales either were born overseas or at least one parent who was born overseas. So on that level, it does make the clause in the constitution quite absurd, but it also means that a lot of people are conscious of it. Like, I'm very conscious of the fact that I'm a dual citizen. Mm. And if I'm walking down the street, people would assume that my ancestry was from not from Australia.
Mm.
I don't think that... I think for someone like John Alexander to just be like, oh yeah, well, of course my dad was born in the UK, but I didn't think that really mattered because it's the UK and he's white. I think it sums up...
I've been here all my life, mate.
Yeah, yeah. It sums up the kind of privilege of those kinds of migrants, those kinds of people, more than anything else. But like we say every week, there'll be more citizenship stuff to talk about next time.
Stay tuned.
Yeah, but no, coming up on the show, we're going to be talking about the latest developments with the Sirius building in Sydney. What the background to it is, why we've been talking about it so much, and you know, where it's kind of headed. But right now we're going to play you this tune from Hermitude. It's from their 2015 album, Dark Knight Sweet Light. It's called Through the Roof, featuring Young Taps. You're listening to Backchat on FBI Radio 94.5 FM and streaming on fbiradio.com. That was Hermitude, Through the Roof, featuring Young Taps out of New Zealand.
So, for most of its life, the Sirius building on Sydney Harbour was just a really visible building. It's the big collection of boxes stacked up looking over Sydney Harbour. You might have seen it if you've ever walked or driven across the bridge. But a few years ago, it became visible in the media as well. It drew a lot of attention when the government announced that it would be removing or attempting to remove its public housing status. And since there have been a few legal cases determining whether or not it should even be allowed to stay standing. So we're joined in the studio today by Sean Carter, who is the chairman of the Save Our Sirius Foundation. He's a local Sydney architect who is really passionate about the building. How are you doing this morning, Sean?
Good. Thanks for having me.
Oh, anytime. So what is the Sirius building and why is it so important to Sydney's heritage?
The Sirius building is a public housing building that sits there on Cumberland Street, The Rocks. It's really important. It's only there because of the Green Band movement, that wonderful cultural movement that sprung up in the late 60s and early 70s to stop a rapacious government demolishing all our heritage. And out of that, 10 years later, the Sirius building was completed to rehouse those people that who lost their housing through the demolition of the...
Can you walk us through that for a second? So the Green Bands were a movement that the Builders Labours Federation was a key part in the 60s and 70s. There was planned to demolish a lot of stuff in the Rocks and build things. How did the Sirius building emerge from that?
Well, they started the demo in the Rocks, and so there were all these people displaced, and Jack and the BLF started
Jack
this
Mundy,
thing.
That is.
Jack Mundy.
Well, he's on first name terms.
No, yeah. I said royalty the other day, and I don't think Jack liked it. An old Marxist, it's not very good. But, so these people were displaced, and these sites were locked up, and locked up for about 4 years. And the Askin government that was then in power soon lost their power, and the progressive RAN government came in and realised how important it was to keep our heritage, started the Heritage Act and its companion, the Heritage Register, and then set about negotiating with the BLF about rehousing these people. And from that, it was decided that on that site where the buildings were demolished, they build new housing to house these people.
And they built beautiful public housing.
Beautiful public housing. The government built public housing, which seems almost an anathema,
but
then was very common.
Interesting. And so what's the trigger for this? Sam mentioned that in 2015, the government announced that it wanted to get rid of Sirius. Well, why do they want to do that? What's going on there?
Well, they'll say they want to get rid of it because they can put a massive uplift on the site and cash out the building, and then we can get a high-rise tower there.
Right.
And use that money to build public housing
elsewhere. And use that money to put public housing elsewhere. Notice they always say elsewhere. We never know where elsewhere is. Interesting, even on Twitter this morning, there's a map that UNSW students have done which locates where the government actually is building. Which confirms all our suspicions where they actually put them... They start at the middle ring suburbs and push them further out.
Yeah, so with that housing money so far, they've built stuff in Cumberland, Blacktown, Parramatta, Fairfield, Georges River and Liverpool.
Yep. Fascinatingly, in the Herald this week, there was an article on jobs and where they've been created.
Right, right.
And Sydney, out of the 500,000 jobs created in New South Wales, 140,000 jobs were created in that 10 square kilometres around the CBD. So what by moving our most vulnerable key workers further from the jobs, you're just entrenching vulnerability of a group of people who don't need any more vulnerability.
Totally, and it's worth mentioning that the government is doing a lot of work on our train lines right now, and a lot of those farther out suburbs are soon to be less service than they are now while they go through those transition periods.
Yeah,
it's an interesting pattern of the Waterloo public housing projects are in a similar state. I think the government is about to demolish them, and similarly, like, oh, people will be looked after, we'll build them new public housing somewhere else. But it seems like when you're uplifting people who have been living in an area for a long time and have a connection to the community, that would create some problems. Is that basically what's been playing out at Sirius?
Look, I don't think they get that these people, you know, they just see them, this particular government sees them, and I think they see them bludging off the public purse.
Right.
And therefore, they're a lesser citizen and they don't deserve these rights. So when they move them on almost like objects and not like people. And as we know, home is one of the most fundamental things we have. Mm. There's a wonderful policy called ageing in place, where if the government really wanted to offload these buildings, at least it could have had the humane policy of let these people age in place. Many of them were quite old. They could have stayed there. Most of them had lived in the area their whole life. Mm. That would have been a much more humane way of doing it. But instead, what they did is apply this maximum pressure. Also led to the politicisation, I think, of family and community services.
Right.
What they've done with the community in the Sirius building, this is the ones that we particularly know about, turning off Myra's hot water for 4 days, Cherie's for 10 days.
Myra and Cherie are the last tenants of Sirius.
And under the guise that, oh, it's just repairs. But can you imagine any landlord allowing their tenants to go without hot water for 10 days?
Yeah, it's appalling.
It's appalling. So
and they put up fences and there's a lot of increased security as well.
It was fascinating. They finally noticed the building and thought they'd look after it 40 years later. And this is the great thing about brutalist buildings is they are civic castles. They're built to last. And Sirius, with little or no maintenance for 40 years, it's bulletproof. You know, you look at it today and you can move into it tomorrow.
Extraordinary.
So that bit of, you know, the government and its departments are really quite dumb and blunt in how they engage with the people. They think it's almost like medicine. Oh, you guys should take this. We know what's good for you. And of course, it just comes across in this day and age of people and free speech and democracy, to see these draconian fences wrapped around a public building just is really quite extraordinary and really says a lot about the government, I think.
Mm. So Sirius is in a bit of legal jeopardy at the moment. Do you want to just walk us through what that process has been and what's been recently decided?
Yeah, it's in jeopardy because the government has again restated that it's going to sell it and demolish the building. The first heritage minister, or the minister of the time, Mark Speakman, refused to list it. The Heritage Council, which is a government department, came out and said, look, we think Sirius should be listed on the State Heritage Register for two criteria. Normally, a building only has one. Sirius had two. Its rare aesthetic value of brutalist architecture and its cultural value.
Hmm.
So Mark Speakman refused that and got caught up, you know, with all this legal language, but seemingly with little consideration. So we challenged that in the Land Environment Court and won on every point.
Yeah, wow.
Which I thought was quite telling because this man is now Attorney General of the state. So the highest law officer in the land got the law wrong a couple of times. But then the court asked the government to remake that decision. And on the last day they had to appeal the loss in the Land Environment Court, they came out and they refused the heritage listing again. So the government, you know, in that great American term that we seem to have adopted, have doubled down again.
Yeah,
they
right.
seem very keen to want to get on and demolish it and sell it and put a 250 apartment high-rise tower on that site.
So what does that mean for Sirius today? Are we out of options? If there are listeners who feel passionate about this, what can they do?
Look, where there's hope, there's always options. And we are not going to give up that fight. We've referred that decision, given the government, this government particularly, seems to play fast and loose with the law. We've referred that decision to the Environmental Defenders Office. They're the community organisation legal office that took the government to court on our behalf the last time.
Right,
so
right.
We've referred that again. And if there's a millimetre of gap in any of the language that the minister used in making her decision, we'll drive the whole Millers Point community bus right through it and challenge them again. But look, the fight does continue. It's important to remember that we have a green ban on that site. So that means no unionised labour will be involved in any of the work on that site. Most of the unionised labour these days are all at the front end of a construction process. So the demo, the excavation, the formwork, Rio concrete. So the building, no building can really get off the ground on that site. Not least that we'll also be there with the unions, with the supporters, and we have now tens of thousands of supporters, and we'll blockade that site and lock it up.
So you've also put out a beautiful book about Sirius. I'm holding it in my hands, yes, actually, just now. You put this together. Why did you put this together?
I didn't personally put it together. Ben Peak, Amira Piscopo, and John Dunn, all of the Save Our Sirius Foundation, put that book together. This is your copy, by the way, guys.
Oh, wow.
Thank you.
FBI special copy.
It's very beautiful, listeners. I recommend you check it out.
Kinikunya by the Lord Mayor this week?
The Lord Mayor, yeah. Was a fantastic event. I think Kinikunya's the best launch they'd ever had was 100 people.
Right, right.
And we had to cap it off at 350 because that's when the RSVPs ran out. I think we had 350 there.
Fantastic. So congratulations.
Thanks. It was a good vibe. But look, the book really is a culmination of, I think John, Ben and Amira really said, well, they saw themselves really as much collectors of information and sharers of information as authors ever since we first started. And the great energy that we get to drive this whole process is the community out there, you know, through our website, through our social medias accounts have flooded us with best wishes, with their artwork. You know, we've had little kids sitting on their high chairs building blocks of cheese in the Sirius form. You know, extraordinary creative and cultural outpouring for the building. So we felt it was really incumbent upon us at this, particularly at this moment in time, to collect all that information, the 10 years before Sirius was actually born, so from the Green Band movement, to record it all the way up to, and it was fortuitous, the cutoff date was just after we'd won the court case. So that was a good record of that moment in time.
Sure. Sean, thanks for joining us on Backchat this morning.
Thanks for having me.
That's Sean Carter. He's the chairman of the Save Our Sirius Foundation and immediate past president of Architects New South Wales, talking to us about the Sirius building. Stick around. We've got one more quick segment we need to do. We'd love to have you in the studio helping us out. It's Backchat Roulette. This is a segment where Sam and I pick a story that we thought should have been talked about a little bit more, or just share an interesting article that we read. Sam, do you want to take it away?
Yeah, sure. So this is one that, if you know me personally, I've been talking about all week. It's called Boko Haram Strapped Suicide Bombs to Them, Somehow These Teenage Girls Survived. It was a multimedia feature in the New York Times. You know, the name's a bit on the tin, but basically Dion Searcy, who's a Africa correspondent for the New York Times, interviewed a whole bunch of young women who were kidnapped by the Boko Haram and then sent out with suicide vests on to detonate themselves in crowds. But these young women obviously were not culpable in any way and figured out that a lot of them could escape doing this terrible thing if they approached police officers or guards and kind of explained the situation. And a lot of these girls actually managed to free themselves and, you know, avoid doing a terrible thing and also stay alive and have found their way back to their families. It's just a really beautiful story that also kind of made some waves locally, because a lot of people living in areas that Boko Haram has influence had started to think that these young girls were intentionally turning on their communities. And this article was kind of like the first step in saying, no, that wasn't the case. Anyway, it's a beautiful read. I recommend it. We'll put the link up.
Worth checking out. Sean, we're springing this on you a little bit, but is there anything you've read or watched or seen or a book that you're vibing at the moment that isn't the Sirius book that you want to share with our listeners?
Look, I'm actually following this guy on Twitter, Simon, with a name that's very hard to pronounce.
Yeah.
And he just puts out graphs and statistics of, you know, just, I guess, life. And just going through that and seeing something displayed graphically is really such a powerful message. I mean, the one I saw this morning was, he was talking about mass shootings, you know, and, you know, that rhetoric from the Gun Foundation.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Guns don't kill people, people kill people.
Yeah, yeah.
And it had the list of, on one side of the graph going up was the amount of guns in the population, and the other side was the amount of mass shootings. And there's this, all these little red dots in the bottom left-hand corner, sort of at the origin. And then on the far diagonal right-hand side with the most amount of guns, the most amount of shootings, is this one red dot.
Yeah, right.
The United States of America.
Yeah, right.
And you look at that and you think, my God, you know, guns kill people.
Absolutely, yeah.
It's and he's just pumping out these extraordinary graphs, and they're mesmeric. You look at them, and then that conveying of message is so powerful.
Awesome. We'll grab that. We'll grab the handle off you, and we'll tweet it out to our listeners. My one is also not quite as happy as some of them have been in the past, but I'm sure a lot of our listeners would be aware of Louis C.K., the U.S. comedian, is the latest high profile figure in the entertainment industry to be accused of sexual harassment and misconduct. And that story's rolling out, but there's a really interesting piece in particular that I wanted to highlight in Vulture. It's called Tear Down the Boys Club That Protected Louis C.K. And it just looks at not just what Louis C.K. was accused of doing, but the way that the culture and the entertainment and the comedy industry protected people like him and continues to protect people like him. And from speaking to some of the people I know involved in the local entertainment and comedy scenes in Sydney and Australia, it seems like we've got a similar problems as well. And it's just interesting watching the Weinstein fallout continue to ripple across and capture everyone, really. So there's probably going to be more stories, but that's my recommendation. And that's all we've got time for on Backchat this morning. Thank you for joining us. As usual, coming up next on FBI is Agenda. And thanks to our special new producer today, Natalie Sekulowska. We're going to leave you with this tune from Julia Jacqueline. It's called Don't Let the Kids Win.